welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies. I'm your host today, Brian Hamilton, and I'm joined by historian Robert Hunt Ferguson, author of the book Remaking the Rural South: Interracialism, Christian Socialism, and Cooperative Farming in Jim Crow, Mississippi. It's hot off the presses, having been published here in the new year by University of Georgia Press. Robert Ferguson, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Rob, I wonder if we could start with you telling our listeners a little about your upbringing and your path to becoming an academic historian.
Sure. I grew up in a town called Eden, North Carolina. My father and grandmother are both high school history teachers. And so I was, from a very young age, surrounded by history books and these wonderful stories. Our family conversations often swerved into the historical. And so that love of history was fostered at a pretty young age for me. I went to college at Western Carolina University and eventually went and got a PhD in history from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And since 2012, I am back at my undergraduate alma mater as an assistant professor of history at Western Carolina University, which is in Cullowhee, North Carolina. To give your listeners an idea, that's about an hour west of Asheville in the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. So that's my academic path.
I love that it's full circle. That's great.
That's right. Yep.
Now, this is the first book-length study of Delta Cooperative Farm and Providence Farm. What drew you to this story, and how is it that no other historians got there first over the past 60 years, do you think?
Well, the second question has confounded me as well. I'm not sure. I will say Delta and Providence Farms have shown up in articles or as essays and collections. Sure. An historian named Fred Smith wrote about Delta Cooperative Farm a few years ago, but this is the first sort of comprehensive study of Delta and Cooperative Farm. In terms of how I got interested in the subject more broadly, for as long as I can remember, I've been interested in how race functions, especially how race functions in America and in the American South more specifically. I can recall at a very young age, probably 10 or 12, this would have been the late 1980s, early 1990s. I was riding bikes around my hometown with a friend of mine, and we rode into the historic downtown district. And from a distance, we saw what looked to us like a parade happening. And we thought, well, great, we'll ride over there and we'll get some candy and it'll be fun. And as we got closer, I realized that it was actually a Ku Klux Klan rally.
Oh my.
And yeah. And at the time, you know, I was, you know, like I said, I was pretty young, but it confused me. I knew what the Klan was. I more or less understood the history of it. And I thought, this is kind of strange that there's a Klan rally in my town where it seems to me everybody gets along. But after that, I started looking at things a bit more critically, even in my, you know, small community, and formulating questions. They were inarticulate questions because I was so young, but about race relations and about, again, how race functions. And that really sort of piqued my interest at a young age. And when I sort of looked just underneath the surface, I realized that my assumptions about, you know, quote unquote, everybody getting along, you know, weren't quite correct. And the few times I asked folks about it growing up, typically the answer would be, well, it's just always been this way. And it wasn't until I got to college at Western Carolina, and I took a class with Richard Starnes. He's actually now my dean, so again, coming full circle. Richard taught a survey course in the history of the American South. And it was in that class that I first realized that there were these important historical moments of interracial cooperation, of blacks and whites coming together to solve collective problems. I learned that segregation was not inevitable. It did not just spring, you know, fully born from the end of slavery. Mm-hmm. That segregation had to be vigilantly maintained by white supremacists. In short, I learned that it hadn't always been this way. and that was not only a historical but a lie that had been maintained for generations. And so I got drawn into these stories of Southerners who had gone against the mainstream to fight injustice. And when I got to a PhD program at UNC Chapel Hill, I knew that I wanted to write on race relations in the rural South. I grew up in a very rural community and had had my interest piqued at a young age. And I went to my advisor, Fitz Brundage, and we talked about this for a while. And he said, well, why don't you go over to the Southern Historical Collection, just a few buildings over, and this wonderful, you know, archive, and tell them your interests and see what they have. And I sat down with the archivists at the Southern Historical Collection, and it was like Christmas morning for them. they said, we've been waiting for someone to come in here and say exactly what you just said. Here are 12 and a half linear feet of papers on Delta and Providence cooperative farms. And that's what I did for the next, you know, 5-6 years. I searched through those papers and eventually write this book.
That's great. Yeah, well, someone who grew up in the North and who taught some school in the North, it just, these are the stories that don't get up there, certainly. They don't get out there very broadly. And I'm so glad to see it. And so let's get into it. So you open the book with a really detailed and fascinating kind of tracing of tracking of the social and intellectual and religious threads that come together in the Mississippi Valley in the 1930s to form and shape Delta Cooperative Farm. Could you help lay those out for our reader, listeners?
Sure. Yeah. Hopefully listeners and readers. the first chapter, as you say, does trace mostly the intellectual and then eventually the practical origins of the first farm that I write about, Delta Cooperative Farms. I trace the origin of Delta Farm by talking about three individuals who I consider to be the essential founders of Delta Farm: William Amberson, Sam Franklin, and Sherwood Eddy. And talking about these three men allows me to also talk about the major intellectual influences on the farm: socialism, an international cooperative movement that was sweeping the world at the time, from Soviet Russia to Japan to the United States. Christian socialism, a certain strain of socialism called Christian socialism, and then labor unionism. William Amberson was a biologist who worked for the University of Tennessee, but in Memphis, so he was close to the Mississippi Delta. He had done some graduate work in Germany and had been exposed to socialism while there. And when he returned to the States, his commitment to socialism and the working class grew. He joined several political and advocacy organizations, started helping the homeless in Memphis during the Great Depression. And those connections with the homeless led him to the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, which had recently formed in Arkansas. And Amberson, in about 1935, becomes rather zealous about solving the problems of the homeless and the unemployed in the Mississippi River Valley. What had happened, in addition to the terrible destitution that the Great Depression caused, in the process of trying to solve fluctuating crop prices, the New Deal passed the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, this New Deal solution to fluctuating crop prices. In practice, what it meant was that large-scale farmers were supposed to remove a certain percentage of their land out of production. And of course, in the South, in plantation agriculture, that meant that sharecroppers not only lost their jobs, but they also lost their homes. Plantation owners simply just kicked them off the land and then kicked them out of their homes that they were renting. So a lot of roadside tent communities popped up in Arkansas, Missouri, a few in Mississippi, and just west of Memphis in Tennessee. And Amberson traveled among these tent communities and was just very taken with the plight of the sharecroppers. And he began to search out other like-minded individuals who would have the knowledge and the means and the commitment to help these sharecroppers sort of start all over. The first person Amberson found was a guy named Sam Franklin. He was a Presbyterian missionary. He had gone to Japan in the early 1930s and worked alongside a Christian Japanese man named Toyohiko Kagawa, who to this day is still revered in Japan as sort of a folk hero and a prominent agrarian reformer, sort of hero to the poor. When relations deteriorated between Japan and China, Franklin returned to the United States, took a graduate course at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and became quite attracted to Christian socialism. When he and Amberson met, Amberson said, "You know, listen, you're probably not going to get to return to Japan as a missionary. Why don't you think about bringing your Christian socialism to the Mississippi Delta? We'll see if we can give these sharecroppers a new life. We've been talking about starting these cooperative communal farms, either in Arkansas or Mississippi, somewhere in the Mississippi Valley. Will you help us out?" And Franklin thought about it and decided that he was excited about the prospect, but it needed money. And that's where this last individual comes into the picture, Sherwood Eddy, who in many ways was a mentor to Sam Franklin. Eddy was the head of missions for the YMCA for a long time in the early 20th century. He traveled the world with the YMCA, and when he came to the Mississippi Delta and saw the destitution among the sharecroppers, he said, this is a sight that I've seen. It's as bad as I've seen anywhere in the world. And he was also sort of convinced to join this effort. And these three men, along with the Southern Tenant Farmers Union a lot of other sharecroppers who were involved in the union, they were the ones who sort of hatched this idea for buying up a lot of farmland. For the first farm, it's a little over 2,000 acres. And Sherwood Eddy had a trust fund, which was lucky. and they found 2,000 acres in Mississippi. And in the spring of 1936, they began moving people over to the farms.
And you had said in the book, you said they do consider Arkansas also as a place. But, you know, as unlikely a place as Mississippi, as you said, they actually thought their chances were better there?
yes, in some ways. The negative thing about Arkansas was that the area in Arkansas where the Southern Tenant Farmers Union functioned had actually had a very long and very violent history of a long history of union activism and a violent history of anti-union opposition, The Southern Tenant Farmers Union had felt that they had sort of antagonized so many planters in the area that they were a little bit more comfortable with searching out places in Mississippi. Of course, in the 1930s, Mississippi had a reputation for white supremacy, for racial violence, and they were essentially trading, you know, one not so ideal place for another not so ideal place. But, you know, this is sort of just those contingencies of history where they ended up in Mississippi because that's where they found cheap land, honestly. Mm-hmm. that's more than anything else explains why Mississippi.
Well, once you get your players there, then you go on in the book to help your readers see how this place functioned, you know, agriculturally, economically, socially, politically. And you seemingly proudly say that you're trying to make clear the tediousness of social justice. And I love that phrase. Could you help us understand how this tediousness is so interesting?
Yeah. So as the book continues, you really delve into the day-to-day of not only of social justice activism, but also the day-to-day of simply living in a rural farming community. And it's interesting how these two things sort of come together, because on the surface, their lives are as prosaic as the lives of anyone else living in rural America in the mid-1930s. Mm. They fall in love, they get married, they have children, they come down with all sorts of illnesses. Their worried about being paid fairly. They have arguments. All of these things that everyday Americans did in the 1930s, they were doing in rural Mississippi as well at Delta Cooperative Farm. But what they were doing that not a lot of other communities were doing was engaging in social justice. And there was often a tension between the former sharecroppers who lived on the cooperative farm and some of the managers. The managers, Sam Franklin was the first manager of Delta Cooperative Farm, highly educated, had traveled the world, was a committed Christian socialist, had very strong Christian ideals. And when he would attempt to explain Christian socialism to some of the sharecroppers, a few of them were immediately on board and understood it completely because they had already been involved in labor activism with the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. But for some, it didn't necessarily compute, nor did it have, in their view, an immediate impact on their lives. And so there was this tension between the management sometimes and the residents. But the successes in social justice abounded on the farm. They started a medical clinic that served both white and black. Most likely, it was the first integrated medical clinic in the country, or I'm sorry, in Mississippi at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The custom for most medical clinics in rural Mississippi was that African Americans either waited in the hallway or the stairwell or out in their vehicles while the waiting room was reserved for whites only. But at Delta Cooperative Farm, the waiting room is integrated. Every summer, there were sisters from the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority who would come down and help out at the medical clinic. So it was also integrated in that way. They had integrated community meetings, integrated labor union meetings. There was a chapter of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union set up at the farms. And they began to try to distribute the earnings of the farm to the residents in an equitable way. The grand plan was that eventually the residents would take over ownership of the farms. And unfortunately, that never happened. But that was the plan initially. And even though it doesn't happen, the payment that these farmers received was much fairer than anything they had received in the past.
Yeah, and the first year they did quite well, right?
The first year they did okay. I would say that from an economic standpoint, the fact that they were a brand new farm, they had not broken ground until late March of 1936, which is pretty late in the season in that part of the country.
Hmm.
The fact that they were not simply a farming community, they were also trying to do all these other social justice initiatives, education initiatives, religious initiatives. The fact that they were juggling all these things and it was in their first year, I think they did quite well. Sherwood Eddy was traveling the country promoting what was being done on the farms, and he was very fond of saying that in the first year, the farm was incredibly financially successful compared to other farms like it. That optimism, however, was not maintained for the next couple of years. And the very next chapter actually begin with the first natural disaster that the residents of the farm faced, the flood of the winter of 1937. It was the most devastating flood they'd had in a decade. It rivaled the Great Flood of 1927 that Mississippi Valley experienced. But the farm had to be evacuated when they finally were able to return to the farm. It was devastated. They were behind schedule again. And that sort of that natural disaster really, really put them behind in the second year of the farm's existence. In addition to that, some of the residents who weren't necessarily on board with living on a cooperative communal farm began to really question the endeavor and butt heads with the management with people like Sam Franklin, who by his own admission was pretty hard-headed too. Mm-hmm. and so external factors hurt the farm in the second year, as well as some internal factors.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk more about some of the, you call paternalism of some of these leaders? You know, they're quite radical, by any standards, I think, but they also are hanging on to some ideas about kind of racial superiority or things like that. Can you kind of help us understand how to think about them in their politics?
Sure. The paternalism aspect of the managers of the farms, is really obvious, to people reading it in 2018.
Yeah.
And you're right, Brian. They were no less radical in the 1930s. They were socialists, and for the most part, the American Socialist Party were gradualists, especially mm-hmm. when compared to the American Communist Party. But
right.
they were gradualists on the issue of full legal integration. They did believe in social equality and racial equality, and they espoused that publicly. But in practice on the farms, Sam Franklin, for all of his, really incredible accomplishments at Delta Cooperative Farm, he often treated the residents, as if they were children. Mm-hmm. And that was as much paternalism towards African Americans as it was paternalism towards the rural poor. I think. Even though Sam Franklin was highly educated, he grew up in the rural South. He was from rural Tennessee, but he had sort of gotten above that and done well for himself. And I think that his own prejudices that he didn't fully realize when he was manager of Delta Cooperative Farm often got in the way of the day-to-day operations and got in the way of him fully explaining exactly what they were trying to do. And he admitted as much later in his life. He actually wrote a small manuscript on his experience at Delta Cooperative Farm that was never published. But in the end of it, he admits that I think he says something like, my sins were concealed to the sinner, but well known to everyone else. and he's talking about his paternalism. He just could not overcome that at the time. But eventually, Sam Franklin leaves. He goes off and joins the war effort in the early 1940s. And a new set of leaders arrive at the farm. And the leadership on the farm becomes truly integrated. There's a white doctor who takes up full-time residence at the farm. There's a white manager, and then a woman named Fanny Booker, who was a native of rural Mississippi. She joins the cooperative effort in the 1940s and is part of the management up until the mid-1950s.
Yeah, I'd like to talk more about Booker. He's such a fascinating character. And you say, there's this controversial purchase of another farm as Delta's mm-hmm. sort of collapsing up and further up in the northern Delta. And you say Booker really, her involvement and the kind of priorities she has really helps to characterize the differences between the two farms.
She does, yes. World War II changes the cooperative effort at Delta Farm. By the beginning of the war, Delta Farm is closing. All of the operations are moving to a second farm that had been purchased in the late 1930s called Providence Farm. The first farm was just south of Memphis in the Mississippi Delta. The second farm, Providence, is it's about an hour north of Jackson, Mississippi. It's in Holmes County. At Providence Farm, it becomes much more focused on sort of African-American self-help, is how I phrase it in the book, I believe. And Fanny Booker epitomizes that. She is her vocation has always been as a teacher. When she comes to live and volunteer at Providence Farm, she actually loses her job in the local school because the farm is rather unpopular. And so she starts a school at Providence, and she starts a summer camp at Providence. Towards the end of the existence of Providence Farm, she begins to talk about voting rights. This is the 1950s. She is in so many ways, I think, emblematic of this grassroots black activism that, you know, lots of great historians have written about that existed in Mississippi and the rural South more broadly. And Fannie Booker brings sort of injects all these new ideas into Providence Farms, and it becomes less about cooperative farming and more about sort of black activism by the 1950s.
Yeah, and the shape of agriculture also is different on Providence than it was at Delta. What are some of those differences?
It is, yes. And I haven't talked that much about the agriculture aspect of it, but Delta Farm, the first farm, they really did envision themselves as competitors with large plantations. So they grew cotton. They attempted to diversify, and they did to a certain degree, but they mostly grew cotton to try to compete with large plantations like the Delta Pine and Land Company, which was by some measures the largest plantation in the world at the time, certainly in Mississippi. And it was right next door, and it was, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres. And here's a 2,000 acre farm trying to compete. That's just not feasible. So at Providence, they diversify what they're growing, but they diversify what they produce, broadly speaking. So in addition to diversifying crops, they have a dairy. They have the new manager actually rents out a few corners of the farm to oil companies, and they sink oil wells and have some income from that. They have a cooperative store where things that are grown and made on the farm can be sold there. They still have a medical clinic, which the income from the medical clinic doesn't necessarily go directly to the farm, but it brings people to the farm. So then they'll come to the medical clinic and shop at the store. Finally, they also started a federal credit union, which was a really big deal. And I always try to emphasize this when I talk about Providence Farm. Your listeners are probably well aware that for sharecroppers to get a loan, they had to go to the landowner, the plantation owner, and plantation owners weren't always interested in figuring the numbers correctly. And of course there was a problem with illiteracy among sharecroppers. So when a federal credit union comes to Providence Farm, it means that for the first time in the residents' lives, most likely they're getting, fair rates on loans. They're getting sort of a fair shake when it comes to getting on their feet, economically speaking. And people come from miles around, several counties away, in order to conduct their business at the federal credit union.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I always get frustrated with overly simplistic narratives of the failure of Reconstruction, thinking that if you just get black folks land, then everything will be better. But you also need credit.
That's exactly right. Capital has to come from somewhere. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. One of the things about the dairy, right, that you come back to a couple of times is that very few of them had any idea how to run a dairy. New to them. And that mattered, right, in this sort of tediousness of this.
But yes. Right? Not to mention, we've talked about the tediousness of social justice and, socialism takes up all of one's nights or whatever the quote is. But the tediousness of the everyday farming life, and some of them were new to some of these endeavors, like the dairy, making sure that the seals on the machines were sealed properly and weren't malfunctioning. Daily bacteria counts drove the manager absolutely batty. and then they had to make sure that the milk was delivered properly across several counties. By the end of the farms, the dairy no longer existed. They just had to sell that and cut their losses with it because it became sort of too large for them to really take care of.
Yeah. And I think it also, I mean, just because of this entire kind of lofty experiment also depended on this agricultural knowledge, right? And there's that moment when Sam Franklin kind of pushes out, is it George Smith, I think his name is, from Delta, mm-hmm. who is a black resident of the region who had lived there for his life, I believe, right? And he said he had kind of this intimate knowledge of the landscape, but Franklin, and Franklin's only one of the only people that has any sort of agricultural background of the people that come to the region, right, from the outside.
Correct.
And so they have kind of this struggle over sort of his ideas of farming versus this kind of local knowledge of farming. Another expression of that paternalism, maybe.
That's right. Yeah, there's there are residents like George Smith, African-American man who had been in the region for a long time and, you know, had dreamed of, you know, basically owning his own chicken farm, and the cooperative helps him get set up with that. And he and Sam Franklin don't always see eye to eye on how to run the farm. Same with a man named Jim Henderson, who was a white sharecropper who, when he moved his family and all his belongings to Delta Cooperative Farm, you know, he stood guard with a shotgun so that the plantation owner wouldn't come and threaten his family. You know, these are rough hewn people, and they had, you know, all their lives they had been farmers, typically farming for someone else. But they had this intimate knowledge that Sam Franklin only had really a glimmer of. And then, of course, you had these very well-meaning, but sometimes a little too idealistic, perhaps, volunteers who would come down every summer, these college students that came from all over. They would come from, you know, other southern locations like, you know, Georgia, North Carolina, but, you know, Wisconsin and California. They would come from all over, typically either through the YMCA or the Society of Friends, Quakers. Mm-hmm. And you know, their hearts were in the right place, but when they would come, they would often think, you know, because they were educated, that they knew better how to operate certain things as well. And it didn't always quite work out well in practice.
Yeah. And you said African-American college students were not permitted.
Yeah. Initially that was true. Okay. That changes later on. But it also coincides with, around World War II, volunteers on the farm become fewer and fewer every summer. Initially, in the 1930s and early 1940s, African-American volunteers were not permitted. And that was a decision, yet again, made by Sam Franklin. And he consulted with a few other people, but ultimately it was his decision. And he justified it by saying, you know, what if we have, you know, young, idealistic African-American students who come from outside the South, and they get to rural Mississippi, and it's not what they imagine, and they run afoul of Mississippi's very strict racial hierarchy, racial norms. Can we protect them? And of course, while that fear was very real, that's also in some ways a paternalistic argument, right? Can we protect them? Right? He's acting like a paternalist. Yeah. So that was his justification for right or wrong. That's what he decided. But again, by the 1950s, there were people passing through the farms, some just curious visitors, some on a volunteer basis, white and black, and it did not matter.
Yeah, yeah. Can we talk a bit about some of the other ways that World War II transformed operations of Providence Farm? You said it was, you know, siphoned off, of course, some of folks that went in the draft, or, you know, Franklin, no, not Franklin, but the doctor that goes off there to serve. Was it Franklin actually begs himself a commission in the Navy, right? Is that right?
He does.
He has to keep asking and asking and asking.
Yes, I mentioned a while ago, Sam Franklin is hard-headed, and he goes to every branch of the military and asks for a commission. And he says, look, I have this practical knowledge. I've lived in Japan. Right. And you would think that he would be, you know, they would jump on someone like Sam Franklin to go off and serve. He's turned down twice over. And after the second time, the very first night, he says, all right, that's it. You know, I've tried. I'll just stay in Mississippi. And the next morning he wakes up and he says, you know, darn it, that's not good enough. I'm going to try again. he does some inquiring, and it turns out that at least it is his impression that when the various branches inquired about Sam Franklin and his suitableness to serve in the U.S. military, that some people had mentioned his farm, and that it was socialist. And I'm sure that they didn't say socialist; they probably said communist.
Sure.
Which of course it wasn't, but that was a distinction lost on most Americans at the time. And that it was interracial. And so Franklin came to the conclusion that he had been somewhat blackballed because of his involvement with Delta Cooperative Farm. But the third try was the charm, I suppose. And he eventually received a commission and went off to war. The doctor, as you say, also left for a time, but he returns at the conclusion of the war and spends the next decade or so living in Mississippi, serving as the farm's doctor. It meant that a lot of the residents went off to war, but more importantly, it meant that a lot of the residents went off to live in urban America, working in the war industry. And so rural life changes because of World War II. I mean, that's been well documented, but but life at Delta and Providence changes because of World War II. Many of the white residents are able to find work in the war industry, while many of the black residents remain in the rural South and remain at Providence Farm. And that's yet another reason why Providence Farm becomes more of a center of black activism than of a sort of socialist communalist farm like Delta Cooperative had been.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, as this is happening, beyond just the personnel effects that the war has, there's also, you say, there's kind of increasing racial anxiety among local white residents as they look at Providence Farm for a couple of reasons.
That's right. And that's I appreciate that segue, Brian. The 1950s, we talked about the Depression and World War II, and the 1950s actually sets up a very different context for what was happening out at Providence Farm.
Start chapter five with the equivalent of a lynch mob, basically.
That's right. Yes, that's right. In 1955, less than an hour's drive from Providence Farm, Emmett Till is murdered. And this is all, front page news. This is a year after the Supreme Court decision to integrate public schools. There are many white Mississippians, including in Holmes County, who are up in arms about what they perceive to be a changing way of life. And it's just a couple of days after the two men who kidnapped and murdered Emmett Till are acquitted that a pickup truck carrying several teenage African-American boys drives by a bus stop just down the road from Providence Farm. Several of the young residents from the farm are at the bus stop. And one of the teenagers yells out of the truck a flirtatious comment. The comment was, "Hey, sugar, you look good to me." And there were several young women at the bus stop, white and African American. And for some reason that we don't know, an 11-year-old white girl who lived at Providence Farm assumes that the comment had been aimed at her, and she begins to cry. She gets on the bus. The bus driver inquires about why she's upset. The bus driver tells the principal. The principal calls the sheriff. And within a matter of an hour or so, the pickup truck and the occupants of the pickup truck are quote unquote apprehended, and they're questioned. Now, I'll sort of cut to the chase to say that what happened to the teenager who yelled at this out from the truck, he said, I was actually speaking to an African-American girl at the bus stop, and I knew her. I was speaking to her. I had no intention of saying anything to this 11-year-old girl. And that didn't matter. He was convicted of uttering vulgarities in the presence of a white woman and sentenced to 6 months on the county farm. But during the questions, during this interrogation, quote unquote, a lot of the questions were about Providence Farm. This teenager did not live at the farm, but he had been to the farm a lot. He had shopped at the community store. He had been with his parents when they had gone to the credit union. He had gone to community events at the community building. And so the sheriff and several people that the sheriff invited into the interrogation, who were all local white, either business owners or, in the case of one person, a white politician, actually served in the state legislature in Mississippi. They asked about Providence. What goes on there? Do they talk about social equality? Do they talk about voting rights? Have you ever heard the word communism? And it was essentially a way to paint the residents of Providence as integrationists, quote unquote, and communists. The next day, a community meeting was called in the closest town to Providence. 1,000 people lived in this town, and 500 showed up to the community meeting. The other 500 were actually at the football game. it was a Friday night. The white doctor and the white manager from Providence Farm got a phone call and said, "You better show up at this meeting tonight," which it was the first time they'd heard of it. So they come out and they are, you know, accused of being communists. They're accused of violating Mississippi's very strict segregation laws. They even accused the doctor at one point of being a spy for Soviet Russia. And at the end of the meeting, the sheriff and a few of the community leaders call for a vote, a show of hands. Who wants these two people and their families and all the residents of Providence Farm to leave the state of Mississippi? And it's a nearly unanimous showing of hands. And as they're walking out, you know, just totally shocked after this meeting, they pass by one of their neighbors, a local farmer, and he's leaning against his truck and he says very loudly to his friends, "What we need for these SOBs are a couple of grass ropes." So right then and there, threatened with lynching, and the farm manager later wrote, he said, I am convinced that they would have lynched us right there if the parking lot had not been littered with children leaving the football game. Because the game had just concluded.
I mean, this it doesn't blindside them in that there's concern, of course, about the sanctity of white womanhood and about interracial sex. It's something that they had at the farms had been very careful to try to avoid the appearance of.
They had. They have been talking about this since the founding of Delta Farm in 1936. And here it is nearly 20 years later. And finally, their greatest fears are sort of coming to fruition. You're right. That doesn't necessarily take them by surprise. But after 20 years, I think there had been a certain comfortableness. Yeah. They saw themselves actually as members of this larger Mississippi community. They did business in town. They collected their mail in town. They got their hair cut in town. Their children went to school with the people who had just voted them out of the county. Their children went to school with the children of the man who had threatened them with lynching. That aspect of it, I think, in some ways took them by surprise. They thought that maybe they had gotten past that. But within several months, the Ku Klux Klan had set up a roadblock at the only road leading into and out of the farm. They were getting threatening phone calls saying, you know, all manner of terrible things in the middle of the night. Their fire insurance had been rescinded. It turns out the local agent for the fire insurance company was a member of the White Citizens Council, which sprang up in opposition to the civil rights movement. And by mid-1956, many of the residents of Providence Farms had left. The doctor closes his clinic. The And he moves his family off to Arizona. The white manager and his family move up to a suburb of Memphis. Fanny Booker and her husband, they stay on the farm until actually the end of her life, about 20 or 30 years later. But it essentially closes in 1956. The Bookers keep the community store open for several years after that. Eventually in the 1970s, it's open for 1 hour a day, one day a week, you know. But after that community meeting and after the threats and after the Klan comes, the farm really ceases to exist like it had before.
It seems to really feed into the historiography on sort of the shift from a broader vision of human rights and economic justice to just a narrower version of civil rights that was possible starting in the 50s and 60s there.
That's exactly right. Yep.
And in retrospect, when you conclude in the book, you find that you think that these projects were both too radical and not radical enough. What do you mean by that?
Putting Delta and Providence in historical context, of course, is absolutely paramount. The Delta Cooperative Farm was radical in so many ways. As a social experiment, it was pretty radical. As a farm, it was nearly destined to fail because they were operating on old models. Tractors were beginning to take over farming by the 1930s, and mechanical cotton pickers were beginning to influence cotton production. And the cooperative farms were pretty slow to take up these new methods. And so in some ways, again, it's radical. In other ways, it's not radical enough. Providence Farm is in some ways so much more interesting to me because it does seem like much more of a grassroots kind of effort than Delta Cooperative Farm ever was. It does have more of a community feel. There are locals who are involved almost from the beginning. And much of what Providence did was also quite radical. It does it is a African-American focused kind of activism, but the activism is quite broad, and that's why I use the phrase human rights over and over rather than civil rights most of the time. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, this wasn't always the case in the 1950s, 60s, but civil rights has come to mean something very narrow, but it wasn't for most people who lived the civil rights movement and participated. As we know, it wasn't just about, voting rights or integration. It was about economic rights. Mm-hmm. And this broader feeling of equal access and this broader feeling of dignity. And that's what Providence Farm offered for a whole lot of people. One of the ways that Providence Farm was not radical enough, as I say, was that by the mid-1950s, it really had no broader connections to the civil rights movement that was really coalescing at the same time that Providence Farm was closing. It could have, if it had maintained many of its connections to its earlier activism network across the country, it may have been able to survive. It could have drawn on the strength of lots of civil rights organizations that were, coming to light in the mid-1950s. But the connections weren't really there. They were sort of an isolated community by the mid-1950s, and they hadn't been earlier. And that also speaks to why within a year after really facing these threats that most of the residents were gone.
Yeah, it's really important. And I hope that much of the months to come will be taken up for you by of public talks and podcasts and getting these stories out there. When the dust settles a bit, you have some more of your own time. What's next on your plate?
My next project, I hope you'll have me back because it's actually an environmental history of North Carolina.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it's not broadly speaking. It's actually taking a few specific episodes, but I'm returning to my home state of North Carolina to do some research. I've been very enamored recently of industrialization's relationship to water in my home state. Hmm. And I mentioned that earlier in the episode that I'm from Eden, North Carolina, and for most of the 20th century, Eden was a hub of the textile industry. And the textile industry left a very significant mark on the water, the two rivers that flow through Eden, North Carolina. The old adage was that you could tell what they were making that day in the textile mills by the color of the water. You know, if it was blue, they were making blue jeans. After the textiles left, Miller Brewing Company came in and had a very specific relationship to the water. And then finally, Duke Power came and set up a coal ash plant in my hometown. And 3 years ago, we suffered the second largest coal ash spill in the country. And so I'm going to be exploring sort of those three episodes and the relationship with the economy and the environment in Eden, North Carolina. And I'm going to hope to draw some broader conclusions about not only what it meant for Eden, but what it meant for towns of similar size to Eden.
What a great way to follow the effluent and kind of let that drive the narrative. That's fascinating.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Robert. And I'm really looking forward to reading what comes next.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.